Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at KSFR.org. We are podcasting at the website SantaFeRadioCafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Venerable Lama Pema Wangdak, who is a Tibetan Lama who's lived in the United States for many years. He will be in Santa Fe this coming weekend, so we'll be talking to him by phone. Right now, I'd like to welcome David Jeunesse. He is author of the book Classic American Popular Song, The Second Half Century, and he's hosting the celebration of the Enduring American Popular Song on Sunday from 4 to 6 at Vanessi of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Nice to be here this morning.
Now, classic American popular song. What does the word classic mean? What genre are you referring to, and what are you excluding?
Well, classic has, I think, several senses. One simply is that it's been around for a long time and is well known. Secondly, it means there's a certain formality to the enterprise, which can be described. You can say this is what makes that kind of song. And that applies to all popular songs and to all music. I mean, we talk about the classic style in classical music, we talk about classic jazz, we talk about classic pop,
classic rock.
It sometimes has the sense of it's been around a long time, but it also means it settled into a groove. It's describable.
So the first two stanzas are like this, and then it goes to a break.
Yeah, you can pretty much predict it. And then it also has something of the character of endorsed by the power structure of the society. I mean, nothing becomes classic unless the people who run the musical society or the greater society say this is worthy of attention.
Which is a funny thing, because who's that power structure? I mean, we're not talking radio DJs, we're talking academia?
Oh, no. I mean, ultimately it goes back to what people want to hear. But each era in the American popular song had a particular delivery system, a particular commercial enterprise behind it that put the music out there. And that changed. That has changed.
And that's something that we'll talk about. But in other words, you're not talking about pop music that we heard on the radio in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. You're not talking about Bill Haley and the Comets or Elvis Presley.
Well, in my case, no, because the other part of my definition is that there is an American popular song tradition that people recognize as beginning around about 1918 with Jerome Kern and Irving Berlin and lasting through, I would say, till almost today or even today, but certainly through someone like Stephen Sondheim in the latter part of the 20th century.
So it's really the tradition that's associated with musicals.
Half of it is. If you look at the format of this kind of song, prior to 1950, about half of the famous ones that you can, where you have records of, you know, how many people listened to what when, about half of them came from the Broadway musical and the Hollywood musical. And the other half is Tin Pan Alley. The other half are people who made a very, very good living writing songs directly for radio and records and singers on radio and records. And those songs, most people today wouldn't recognize the songwriters' names because they know all the songs.
Right.
And they're in our consciousness.
What are some examples of those Tin Pan Alley songs that a lot of people know?
Oh, well, something like April Showers or Lullaby of Broadway or Irene or Yes, We Have No Bananas even.
Okay. Or,
you know, we all know those songs. We couldn't say who wrote them.
Exactly.
But they were very, very popular.
So one thing that I think, and we talked about this the other day on the program with somebody who has a chorus that sings medieval music, and I think it's really worth talking about the major changes in how music was listened to between the 19th and the 20th centuries, and then how that developed in the 20th century. What were people listening to at the turn of the last century? I mean, they didn't, I don't even know when the radio was invented, but
well,
the whole thing of radio, records, concerts, cabarets, musical theater.
That's a good way to start, because at the turn of the 20th century, there was no microphone, and there really wasn't a pop music record business. I mean, I suppose there were recordings, but they would be recordings of music hall songs, or sort of English Edwardian type songs, or the kind of songs that you heard at county fairs and things like "Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nellie" would come from around 1900.
Now, how did they record them if there were no microphones?
Well, they went into the studio and they did record them, but there was no industry that put millions of singles out as that developed into the 20s and 30s. The microphone really began what most people call the Great American Songbook, or what I call classic American pop.
Now, before that, you had to have a superbly resonant voice to fill a concert hall.
Yeah, and it made the songs different. Because if you were Al Jolson or if you were Sophie Tucker and you were standing on a vaudeville stage, you had to sing to 1 or 2,000 people, and you had to sing at the top of your lungs, and you could not be subtle and you could not be intimate. So you just had to let her rip. And that's what I mean, music hall style.
Right, right. And you also couldn't play outdoors to a stadium of tens of thousands.
Unless you had a very loud voice.
Let's start in 1950, which is around when your book starts. And your book picks up from the work, I think it's important to mention, of Alec Wilder, who has a great work encompassing the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, 1950 is kind of a watershed year. Alec Wilder wrote a book called American Popular Song, and he meant what I mean. He also excluded these other genres. He published it about 1974, and everybody got very excited because even though most people then knew the songs he was writing about, namely 1918 to about 1950, attention had turned away from those songs. He kind of like revived the genre. And then he had a radio program on National Public Radio that was very, very popular. But it's very interesting. When he wrote the book in 74, after rock had come in, after many famous Broadway musicals like West Side Story had appeared, he said the Great American Songbook stopped in 1950. And not only he, but one of the reasons I wrote this book was that in the 80s and 90s, I realized that musicologists, fancy musicologists, and cultural journalists, and music historians were all subscribing to this dictum. The Great American Songbook lasted from 1918 to 1950. And I knew it wasn't true. Now, in Wilder's case, he hated rock so much that he couldn't listen to the music that was going on. Jazz, rock.
He didn't even like jazz?
No, he didn't like
that music.
He liked jazz chords, but he didn't like bebop or any kind of hard jazz.
Right, right. Because so there's jazz influence in the theater and popular music that you're talking about.
I hope we can talk about that. But he was so appalled by what he thought the implications of rock coming in that he didn't really think through it.
Right.
And then that kind of got disseminated, and everybody said, oh yeah, 1950, that's the end of the tradition. And I knew it wasn't the case. Now, I must say, there were huge changes in the delivery systems of American popular music that did start in the late 40s and went on. And so it is true that the Tin Pan Alley tradition of the classic American popular song did cease.
What do you mean by delivery systems?
Well, let me back up a bit. If you were growing up in the early 1940s, what I call the classic American popular song was the only national popular song style. It's the only one that melded everybody together, because if it didn't matter where you lived, if you listened to radio, if you went to the movies, or if you went to big band concerts, that music was played all over the country, and that was it. Radio was four networks, and the feeds came from New York, and they took the songs from Tin Pan Alley and from Broadway and so on, and that was it. It's true, you would know regional music. You know, you'd know Tex-Mex or Appalachian or Franco-Americans, you know, if you lived in Maine or that kind of thing. You would know it natively as an individual, but that wasn't shared nationally. There wasn't any mechanism for getting that out. That began to happen when the monopoly of radio was broken in the late 40s, when movie musicals began to peter out, so you didn't get them cranked out in Hollywood anymore, when the Broadway musical began to change. There was no longer any economic reason for anybody to be sitting in New York writing a song for, you know, Doris Day. Her songs, in fact, they did try to write for Doris Day and Johnny Mathis and Tony Bennett, but it wasn't very successful. But in the old days, they would be writing songs for Bing Crosby and, you know.
Right. So what was the new thing that was happening that came in?
With the advent of the LP, which allowed you to be an archivist of songs, you could buy, you know, Ella Fitzgerald sings Cole Porter, and you'd have 30 songs on that double LP record.
As opposed to the old days where you had
a single.
A single. Yeah. Whether it be a 78
right.
or a...
You could, first of all, breakable records had gone away, so now it was 45s. 45s were easy to ship, and 45s were what allowed, you know, Elvis and Bill Haley and B.B. Albert King and so on to make a splash across the country. Easy to ship, and radio monopoly was broken, so now you had powerful signal local stations that could play whatever they wanted to. You could originate music in Nashville or Waco or anything, and it would go out nationally. And also, the society had changed. I mean, we were mixing so much more beginning after the Second World War, you know, mixing races and ethnicity and mixing our cultures. And that really hadn't happened before. You'd had white bread culture, you know, white middle class culture, and regional culture, and that was it. So the delivery system changed, the musical diminished in importance, Tin Pan Alley was no longer a factor, and the classic American song continued to be written, but it tended now to go into maybe cabaret, you know, for the specialists.
Right, and so instead of being a shared culture that everybody knew, it became something that only a smaller segment of society was really interested in.
That's right. Now, the irony, Mary Charlotte, is that by far the most successful Broadway musicals of all time, almost all of them occurred after 1950. I mean, to put it the other way, there were lots and lots of serviceable musicals on Broadway and movies from 1920 up to 1950, but with the exception of Showboat and Oklahoma and Carousel and maybe something like Pal Joey, those were not blockbuster shows that everybody in America knew. The songs that came out of them circulated widely, but the shows were only known to people in New York or
so
the tryouts.
So what were the great blockbusters of the second half of the 20th century?
Oh, Laura, this is why it's so odd that people say the Great American Songbook stopped in 1950. The King and I, Sound of Music, Gypsy, Bells Are Ringing, West Side Story, Cabaret, Chicago, The Music Man, Chorus Line, Sweeney Todd, Fiddler on the Roof, for goodness sake,
right.
My Fair Lady.
Right.
I mean, those are the most successful musicals of all time, and they did generate songs of this kind.
Now, then there were also other ones like Hair, which they're reviving in New York
right.
now, and Jesus
right.
Christ Superstar, which I guess don't fit into your song style so
They're
much.
Not in my style.
Right.
Now, the long play record, of course, allowed original cast recordings to start about 1950. There were original cast recordings before, but they had a very small sale because they were on 78.
We're talking to David Janess. He's author of the book Classic American Popular Song, The Second Half Century. And he is going to be hosting the celebration of the Enduring American Popular Song on Sunday, March 8th from 4 to 6 at Vanessi of Santa Fe. And you will be playing, as well as some other musicians whom we'll talk about in a few minutes. But let's hear a recording of some of the music that you actually will hear you singing and playing and so on. But why don't you choose a song, and then we'll talk about it.
Well, let's choose a very old-fashioned kind of Cole Porter song, which is number 2 on the CD that you have.
Why don't we go ahead and hear that, and then we'll come back in a moment.
I used to dream of a starlighted stream where me and my girl would first meet. So try to surmise my terrific surprise when love beckoned in 52nd Street. I thought a breeze would appear in the trees and sing something tender and sweet. But how could it sing with a band playing swing when love beckoned on 52nd Street? Now when we want to coo, country lanes are taboo, and Old West 52 is our favorite beat while we're on our feet. So you can bet I shall never forget that night, second, when I first reckoned that love beckoned on 52nd Street. When we want to coo, country lanes are taboo, and old Rue 52 is our favorite beat while we're still on our feet. So you can bet I shall never forget that night, second, when I first reckoned that love beckoned on 52nd Street.
So that's music of Cole Porter, sung by David Jeunesse, whom we have right here in the cafe with us.
I think that's an interesting song. It's Cole Porter from the 30s, but, and it is Cole Porter because it's New York and it's high-spirited, etc., but it also refers to the great lullaby of Broadway dance tradition. It's a dance number. It refers
right
to Tin Pan Alley and those high-kicking, you know, chorus lines and so on. So it's written already in a kind of fond style, looking back to like 42nd Street.
Right, exactly. So so it evolves from there to what are we dealing with and how is it different from Cole Porter in the period that you are addressing?
Well, Cole Porter's heyday was really before 1950. He did work until about 1960-something, but he wasn't as good after 1950. That's another reason why the 50 cutoff doesn't make sense, because all the great songwriters were active after 1950, except for Jerome Kern, who had died.
Well, it seems like all those boundary lines, whether it be art history or anything else, are just by necessity artificial.
Yeah, but I think that assumption about 1950 reflects societal change and this change in technology and the change in the way people were listening to pop music. I mean, you're right. There's no decisive cutoff, and it all merges together.
Right. But
Cole Porter, the more familiar Cole Porter, was, you know, much jazzier. The lyric was much more sophisticated. He used Latin rhythms a great deal, and he had this wonderful harmonic sense that he took from, essentially with jazz in mind, where harmonies change not just on the strong beats the way the old-time songwriters did, but all the way through, several times in measure, and there was constant harmonic motion, which was very new in American popular music.
His lyrics are also quite wonderful, and one has the feeling that Dr. Seuss must have liked him very much.
Well, some of his lyrics are a little tawdry, and some are kind of silly, but most are wonderful, yeah.
And very clever in their rhymes,
yeah,
and so
yeah
on. So let's talk about the influence of jazz on classic American song.
Interesting topic, and if I can just double back to the Vanessi program that's coming up on Sunday, we're featuring two strands of American music. One is Jerome Kern and really old American popular song music, and the other is Brazilian bossa nova. And what's interesting about that is those are the two great American popular song traditions, and they both they have amazing parallels. Except for the very early years, like pretty clunky or simple songs by Irving Berlin, when the American popular song tradition got going, it obviously was using rhythms derived ultimately from the Caribbean and before that from Africa. I mean, this is true of Dixieland and then swing and then jazz-oriented songs of the 40s. The melodies and the format of the song, the way the song is constructed, symmetrical phrases, 2 and 4 bar units, and the nature of the melody is basically European. That's right. Where it came from. And this is also true in Bossa Nova. The melodies are traditional Eurocentric or Euro-derived melodies combined with a beat. The Brazilian beat was the samba beat, and that's different from the beats we first used, although Cole Porter and others and people in the 40s and 50s began using all kinds of Latin rhythms. It was a big change in American popular music. So what I'm saying is this mixture, this creole of European and Caribbean or Afro-Caribbean exists in both cultures. I think they're equally beautiful and equally important. And you were asking about jazz. Jazz got more and more of an influence on the American popular song. But I must say there came a point where when jazz got very, very sophisticated, post-bebop, there were jazz vocals. And jazz vocals are not American popular song. They're, you know, scatting and quick, very elaborate, highly rhythmic, almost like rap today.
Right. Anita O'Day, whose wonderful film has been playing in Santa Fe.
Yeah. She straddled that. I mean, she sang the Great American Songbook, but she did it in a highly jazz-inflected way, which is great.
Now, why is the word used songbook? Was there some books that collected them?
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but actually, you're right. About the time that Alec Wilder wrote his book, publishers began to put out the complete songs of Rodgers and Hammerstein, or the complete songs of Cole Porter. And LPs also started to put out, you know, Ella Fitzgerald's songbook.
The Cole Porter songbook, right, yeah.
Were compilations. Yeah. So songbook in that sense meant just collection, looking backwards, kind of.
Right. Well, it's actually time to go, unfortunately, but let's remind people that we are talking to David Jeunesse. He's the author of the book Classic American Popular Song, The Second Half Century, and the celebration of the enduring American popular song is a big to-do happening this Sunday, March 8th, from 4 to 6 at Vanessi. And it will feature not only David Jeunesse, who will be singing, but also musicians Burt Dalton, Luis Guerra, and Patti Stevens. And all proceeds will go to benefit Recursos de Santa Fe. So an event not to be missed. Now, should we go out with one more song?
Sure. Do a jazz-inflected ballad. It's number 15. It's by Johnny Mandel, who is a Hollywood composer highly influenced by the jazz sound.
David Jeunesse, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
The evening, when the kettle's on for tea, an old familiar feeling settles over me, and it's your face I see, and I believe that you are there. In a garden, when I stop to touch a rose and feel the petals soft and sweet against my nose, I smile and I suppose that somehow maybe you are there. When I'm dreaming and I find myself awake without a warning, and I rub my eyes and fantasize, and all at once I realize it's morning, and my fantasy is fading like a distant star at dawn. My dearest dream is gone. I often think there's just one thing to do. Pretend the dream was true. And tell myself that you